This is Rag Radio, and I'm Thorne Dreyer. We're at KOOP.org, but we're also streamed live on the World Wide Web, and our show is also rebroadcast. We're syndicated, and the show is rebroadcast on a number of other radio stations around the country, community radio stations, and our podcasts go all over the place. So we have fun here, and we had a little confusion starting this because we're doing a show on through Skype, which I've never done before. Because you remember, you folks who know me know I'm something of a Neanderthal, a troglodyte or whatever you call it, Luddite. So, even though I work on a computer all day long, my guest today is Gordon Lafer. Gordon, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Gordon is the author of The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America One State at a Time. Gordon is associate professor at the labor Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon. He served as senior labor policy advisor in the House of Representatives. What was the committee?
Education and labor.
Education and labor. And he is a political economist. He's the author of The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America One State at a Time, as we said, and The Job Training Charade, both from Cornell. He served as senior policy advisor in the U.S. Congress, I said, and he's been called to testify as an expert witness before multiple state legislatures. This is a very interesting and I think a very important book. This is part of the description of the book. In the aftermath of Citizens United, it's become commonplace to note the growing political dominance of a small segment of the economic elite. But what exactly are they doing with their newfound influence? Gordon Lafer's The 1% Solution is a comprehensive account of legislation promoted by the nation's biggest corporate lobbies across all 50 state legislatures and encompassing a wide range of labor and economic policies. Richard L. Trumka, who's president of the AFL-CIO, said, in The 1% Solution, George Lafer exposes the vast conspiracy between corporate special interests and their allies in government to rig the rules of our economy and democracy to favor the wealthy few. Anyone who is committed to turning the tide back in favor of working people must first understand what we are up against, and that means reading this book. It's a fascinating book. It's an incredibly important topic at this moment. We are losing, are we not, our democracy, if we aren't careful. How did you gain interest in this subject, and how did you decide to write this book?
Well, I was working in the Congress in Washington, D.C. until the end of 2010, and then in early 2011 is when Wisconsin stripped away union rights from all the state's public employees, and there were huge protests about that. And then I started seeing similar things happening in other states, and every place they happened, people tended to think, oh, this is because of Governor Walker, this is because of, you know, whoever, some person, and it was particular to that personality in their state. And I realized that couldn't be true. So what this book is I spent 5 years, this tracks all of the legislation that passed with the backing of the big business lobbies in all 50 state legislatures in the years since Citizens United, across about 30 different issues about jobs, workplace, you know, schools, public services. And I wanted to see, well, what does it look like when you put all the pieces together of what really is the corporate legislative agenda?
Okay. By the way, Wisconsin. You know, Wisconsin was a turning point, wasn't it? And a lot of people thought maybe it was going to be a turning point in the other direction because of the incredible demonstrations that happened and the sort of rallying of forces. But it sure didn't happen that way, did it?
That's right. And I think part of that is because, you know, when people can vote on a particular issue, there's very widespread bipartisan support for a lot of progressive things like raising the minimum wage, having a right to paid sick leave, having fair scheduling hours. But when you vote for candidates, people vote for candidates for all different kinds of reasons. So in Ohio passed a law a lot like Wisconsin's that stripped away union rights. But in Ohio, citizens had the right to vote just to overturn that law, which they did. In Wisconsin, they had to do recall elections of politicians, and those are much more difficult. So they, as you said, that did not change anything in Wisconsin.
How critical is Citizens United?
Citizens United is huge, and I think people don't notice it, and don't notice it especially at the state level. You know, most people find politics boring, and if they pay attention, they pay attention to the White House and the federal government. But Citizens United made a sea change in state politics. There was a huge increase in corporate spending. You know, there's unlimited corporate cash in politics, and state legislatures are cheaply bought. Most state legislative races you can buy for $50,000, $100,000, which is a lot of money to a person, but not a lot of money to the country's biggest corporations. And so you have a state like Wisconsin, even, which in the vote for president is a toss-up. It's one of the battleground states. But in the state legislature is a hard right-wing state legislature. And that's true in Virginia. It's true in North Carolina. It's true in Michigan. So it's made a huge difference. And the state governments have a lot of control over things that impact our everyday life. Most people don't pay attention to it until it does impact your own personal life.
I think you pointed out that a lot of this was already in motion, certainly, before Citizens United. Citizens United just kind of created the avenue to make it happen. Alex, I guess, has been an incredible force in creating reactionary state law and in doing it in a comprehensive way all around the country. Often you find laws that are written in exactly the same language, and they come right from Alex. Alex is what?
So the American Legislative Exchange Council is Alec, and for people who don't know,
I said Alex, didn't I?
That's okay. You know, this is the most important vehicle through which the country's big corporations coordinate their political action at the state level. The way ALEC works is about one quarter of all state legislators in the country are members. They pay $50 a year in dues. All the rest of the money is paid by hundreds of big corporations. And it's like Coca-Cola and Facebook and pharmaceutical companies and oil companies and tech companies, a lot of companies that everybody's heard of. They meet several times a year in resorts where they sit in committees, and the committee is half state legislators and half corporate lobbyists. And they sit in those committees and they write model legislation that has to be approved by a corporate board and then gets introduced in cookie cutter fashion in state after state. And that's how you see corporate written bills that are showing up all over the country in different state legislatures.
Okay. We're talking with Gordon Lafer. Gordon is the author of The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America One State at a Time. It's funny because we look at the national scene so often. I mean, that's where our focus is. And yet all of this stuff is happening down on the state level that, you know, maybe in our state we see it, but we don't realize how comprehensive it is.
That's right. But it's really happening in states across the country. And, you know, the corporate lobbies have enough money to pay attention to things that normal citizens don't pay attention to. I mean, less than one quarter of Americans can even name who their state legislator is, much less pay attention to specific issues. And that's understandable. But unfortunately, when nobody's paying attention, it makes it all the easier for moneyed interests to get what they want. And what they want is not surprising. It's for them to be richer and everybody else to have less.
And we've thought this was happening for a long time, but now it's happening at warp speed.
That's right. And it's largely because, I mean, corporate lobbies doubled. They were already the dominant force in American politics, but doubled how much they spend on politics since 2010. And Citizens United also made it a lot easier for people to spend money on politics secretly in a way that nobody can tell where the money comes from. And that's very appealing to companies who might be embarrassed or might be afraid of being boycotted for supporting certain things. But now they don't have to be embarrassed because nobody knows it's them and they still get what they want.
Well, what is the agenda of the carpet? What is the agenda of ALEC? What is it they're trying to get?
So it's scary. In a lot of ways, you know, one of the things I would say is in some ways it looks like, you know, in the 1980s when people talked about companies divesting from like the upper Midwest and just leaving the Rust Belt, to a certain degree there are corporations that kind of treat America like this. And this is a product of how globalized the economy has become. So I looked, for instance, you know, there's a 1953, the president of General Motors said, what's good for GM is good for America. So I don't know if that was ever exactly true, but it was more true when GM's cars were made by Americans and bought by Americans. Now, a majority of GM employees and two-thirds of the cars they sell are overseas. And that's true of a lot of companies. And so you have, for the first time in American politics, some of the biggest, most powerful actors in American politics are companies whose interests are increasingly divorced from the American people. Like, we don't let foreign companies contribute to American politics, but a legally American company, even if they make most of their money overseas, can spend an unlimited amount on politics. So we see companies that are not investing in anything except their own short-term return. They're not investing in highways and bridges and the electrical grid. They're not investing in making the water system better. They're not investing in making the school system or the healthcare system better. And what they're doing is, you know, a lot of people see the attacks on unions. When the attacks on unions come out, the corporate lobbies try to say, we're attacking government employee unions because we want to help the hardworking non-union taxpayers in the private sector. And then you look and think, okay, well, what are they actually doing for hardworking non-union taxpayers in the private sector? And what they're doing is they're trying to cut the minimum wage. They're trying to get rid of a right to sick leave. They're gutting unemployment insurance. They're cutting education funding. They're cutting health care. Basically, in every way possible, they're moving money from the normal working Americans to the elite, and also taking rights away from the majority of working people.
There seem to be a lot of things that have led in this direction, a lot of paths. And one thing I should think maybe is the change in corporations in terms of the bottom line and in terms of their commitment now to shareholders' profits, in that sense, very little commitment to the public good. Am I?
You are absolutely right. And, you know, it took about 30 years for laws to change to create what people call the financialization of the economy, which, you know, the most important result is in the 1970s, about 60% of every dollar of profit that most corporations earned was plowed back into the company, either buying new machinery, higher technology, worker training. Now that's 10%. Almost all of the money is going to pay dividends or share buybacks to help shareholders. And almost all of the big, you know, the Fortune 500 companies got restructured in a way where their agenda is just short-term shareholder return. So even when you see something that you say, well, this is objectively in their long-term self-interest, like feeding the school system or building highways, they're not operating on a long-term time horizon. They're looking at what's going to increase shareholder return in the next quarter or the next 2 years. And that means they act in a way that doesn't invest in any of the long-term social infrastructure or physical infrastructure of the country.
And this is not the traditional way it's been done. There's obviously always been that. I mean, capitalism, profit motive. But it seems like it's really gone to the extreme.
Right. I mean, some of this is not new. I mean, the Chamber of Commerce 100 years ago was opposed to the minimum wage and opposed to restrictions on child labor and opposed to the 8-hour day. But it's new that their interests are just about short-term shareholder return. It's the degree of globalization is new. So the degree to which Americans matter less to them is new. And also, you know, as our economy has grown so unequal in terms of who has money, then you have a decision like Citizens United that says, rich people and corporations can spend as much as they want on politics. It means that economic inequality gets translated into political inequality. So, you know, the rich wanting to be richer, that's not new. That's as old as time. But the way it functions now is different from how it functioned 30, 40, 100 years ago.
So the more it becomes like a plutocracy, the more there's what I've always seen from the right is this need and ability to consolidate power once they get it. The question is this becoming irreversible?
Well, I don't think it's irreversible. I mean, it's very bleak. And, you know, sometimes I feel like, you read this book and you get to the end and like, what is there to do except head to the nearest bar?
Yeah.
But I don't think it's hopeless. The reason it's not hopeless is that even though the corporate lobbies have huge power, the one thing they have failed to do is convince most people that their ideas are good ideas. I mean, people still vote for conservative politicians for all kinds of reasons, but on an issue-by-issue basis, a lot of the corporate agenda is unpopular among both Republicans and Democrats.
Well, and it's go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
It's interesting, too, because, you know, here we've got situations with social issues where actually the Chamber of Commerce and corporate interests are coming out on the what we might say the progressive side. But that's all got to do, I guess, with where they see the the bottom line being, and if it's going to cost them money, for instance, if it's going to cost them money if you have repressive measures in North Carolina or something, and it's going to keep businesses out and it's going to be, keep sporting events out, then some of the social issues, it seems like things get twisted. And even Donald Trump, you know, everybody thought, well, a lot of people thought that he was this economic populist, you know, he was this international populist, but on social issues, he was probably kind of liberal. And yet, that's all just turning on its head, it seems like. I'm not sure what the question is exactly. But
well, I'll give you an answer. I don't know if it's the answer to this question.
Since we don't know what the question is.
The corporate lobbies overwhelmingly don't care about the social issues. I mean, they're not... And I think for that reason, it's important to distinguish between corporations and individuals. Again, there's a lot of attention paid to not just to Donald Trump, but to people like Sheldon Adelson, you know, kind of rich billionaire activists. And those people may be moved by things that are idiosyncratic or their own ideology. But when we talk about ALEC and we're looking at several hundred of the biggest companies in the country, at some point in each one of those corporations, there was a meeting of the Government Affairs Committee or their executive committee where they decided it's in our rational interest as a corporation to put time, money, and energy into supporting the ALEC agenda. And that's not for them about racism or about marriage equality or about any of that kind of stuff. So I think for us as citizens, we need to look at that clear-eyed, look behind the circus of the personalities and behind the politicians and say, well, who is it that is really the most powerful actor in determining who gets into office and what they do in office, and how do they understand their rational interests? What are they really aiming at? That's what the goal of the book is to make that clear to people, whether they're conservative or liberal, so we can approach this with clear eyes.
Okay, we're talking with Gordon Lafer. Gordon is the author of The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America One State at a Time. We'll be right back after this. Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. I want to thank Tracy Schultz, my compadre and engineer and taker of flack, receiver of flack.
doing something a little different, but it's a fun challenge.
It's sort of a slightly overcast day, but we are in Nirvana here in Austin, Texas, so we can't argue too much, I guess.
can't complain too loud.
We're back with Gordon Lafer. One thing I love about your book, for somebody who's interviewing you, Gordon, is that the 1% solution, how corporations are remaking America one state at a time, it includes its own explanation of what it is. I mean, it's pretty self-evident. And I think I think a lot of people, as you point out, just this is happening, has been happening under the surface. I mean, it's under the radar. I guess what I want, the way in which the corporate lobbyists and ALEC and their cohorts have managed to have such incredible, be so incredibly effective, it's almost frightening. This last election, of course, created some very interesting dynamics, especially with Trump and Sanders, even Clinton for Sanders. And there's been this sort of resurgence of grassroots activism, progressive activism. And I think the Democratic Party is sincerely, one hopes, putting a lot more energy into the local level, into electing people on the very local level. Do you think that this means anything? Can this actually, do you see this happening? And do you think, what kind of chances do you think there are of actually having some effect?
Well, you know, I think that it all comes from the huge crisis of inequality and economic hardship that we're in, which, you know, was made worse by the Great Recession in 2008-09, but really is a 40-year trend of life, you know, slowly, gradually, but relelentlessly getting harder for majority of Americans. I mean, we're now 60% of men in America now work for less, in, when you adjust for inflation, than the equivalent people did in 1979, which means there's about 70 million American men who are working for less than the equivalent of what their fathers or grandfathers made. Families, if you look at family income, it's a little better, it's kind of flat, but that's because women are working many more hours. The average two-parent family now works the equivalent of 7 full weeks a year, more than they did in the 1970s. So that crisis just goes year after year after year, and I think it's got to the point where the normal kind of solutions aren't appealing to voters. You saw the two candidates that got by far the most enthusiasm were Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, who both spoke to that, like, we need to do something that is radically different from what we've been doing. It's not a situation that just, you know, requires a nicer touch or a little tweaking here and there. The real question is, you know, traditionally, not just in America, but every place, when people get, you know, are downwardly mobile economically, it creates a lot of anxiety, a lot of rage, a lot of anger, and that can go left or right. And the people at the top are trying hard to not have that anger aimed at the economic elite. And then it gets aimed at immigrants or gay people or black people or wherever it goes. So the real question, it seems, I mean, it's not like you need me to say this, it's probably obvious, is does the anger and anxiety that comes from economic inequality end up moving in a progressive direction and being aimed at the people who are really at the top, or in a right-wing direction where working people just end up attacking each other?
Attacking each other, where it's interdirected. And one of the things that happened, in the difference between, you know, during the campaign, I always hated it when people said, kind of kept comparing Sanders and Trump, because they couldn't be different, more different animals. And the fact that Trump, you know, the kind of nationalist, the white nationalist, the misogynist, the hedonist, all of that part of him ended up being aimed at turning people against each other, which can be a pretty effective way to be a politician, to gain power in politics. But the ways that he addressed the economic issues in the country were fraudulent. Telling people he's going to bring the coal industry back, that he's going to create all these jobs, that ignored the fact that, you know, what globalism has done and whatever. Anyway, I'm not here to lecture, but but I always do. So, yeah, I mean, I can't stay out of it. Response.
I mean, I also think it was fraudulent, but I think it tapped into something that is real. You know, he said, make America great again. And at some point, Hillary Clinton said, America already is great.
Oh, yeah,
well,
yeah.
You know, America does not feel great to many, many people. And I think, you know, for coal miners who think, you know, the Democratic Party or like the upper middle class Democrats' answer to global warming is me and my family and community should be out of work. And that's it. There's no backup plan.
Right.
There's no saying, because your family is going to pay the price for global warming, we'll give you a pension for life. There's no other job. That's it. I think, you know, that's true. And I know people, I know steel workers who wanted to vote for Bernie Sanders, and when they didn't have that option, voted for Donald Trump because they wanted the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement to be killed. So I also think that Trump ran on the promise, essentially, of providing decently paying jobs for people without college degrees, and he's not going to do that. And you can already see the people he's put in his cabinet are a lot of Wall Street people. But I understand the kind of anxiety and desperation even that led people to place hope in him, given that he was saying, you know, he was kind of speaking a good game.
Do you think they will be, and if so, how long before they're disillusioned and kind of see through it? It seems to me that it's happening on some levels already.
It's starting to, but, you know, usually it takes 3, 4, 5 years. People give their candidate the benefit of the doubt, and, you know, it depends somewhat on, you know, what's he really going to do with infrastructure. But in a way, if 3, 4, 5 years from now it becomes clear to the majority of people who placed hope in Trump that he's not really making life better for working class people, my fear is that at that point his only option is to whip up even greater frenzy around white nationalism, and that's an even more dangerous time for us. And I think, you know, people need to be educated to see clearly what's going on to not fall for something like that.
Has there ever been any candidate who has given more benefit of the doubt for in so many ways? You know, it's just amazing, I think.
Well, I don't know. But I would say, again, on an issue-by-issue basis, there's grounds to be hopeful. And to give you an example, Arizona last November voted for Trump over Clinton, and by a much wider margin voted to raise the state minimum wage and create a right to some minimum days of paid sick leave for everybody in the state. And when you look at the math, there must have been at least several hundred thousand people who voted for Donald Trump and also voted to raise the minimum wage and create a right to paid sick leave. So he may be running the country in a Wall Street way, but that's not what even his voters voted for. And I think that's the grounds of hope in trying to figure out a way forward.
Yeah, it's just amazing to me to think about what's going to happen next. And there's so many ways that he cannot deliver what he promised to deliver. And so we have to wonder what happens then. And I don't know whether the way the term word populism has been used now, it's where my friend Jim Hightower would consider it to be a gross violation. That he would say that Trump was no populist and that his appeal wasn't even a populist appeal.
I agree. He's certainly no populist. But, like, again, I think it's, you know, our conversation has kind of naturally gone towards Trump and the White House and the federal government. And I understand that. But at the same time, just last month, Iowa did the same thing that Wisconsin did, took away union rights from public employees, was the first state to roll back its minimum wage and erased minimum wage increases in 4 counties and banned any other city or county from raising the minimum wage. And so things are happening. You know, the corporate lobbies are not waiting for the mystery of Trump to become clear. They're moving in the 50 states, and people need to be paying attention to that as well.
Well, in relation to what you said a minute ago, I think one of the things that we find in polling, those of us who still out there believe in polling, and I think that what happened with polling in the election, that was a pretty unique thing, and trying to figure out an election in this day and time is different from maybe finding out popular sentiment. They're a little better at that. Is it generally any kind of polling seems to find that the populace is much more liberal or much more progressive, even though they might call themselves conservatives. But when it comes to issues, they're much more progressive than what their legislature represents, for one thing. And part of the problem is when I mentioned earlier the question of consolidation of power. Those legislatures, you know, they've gerrymandered and done everything under the sun to create unrepresentative groups of people.
That's right. And I think one of the scariest trends like that I would say is like the shrinking of our democracy is that corporate lobbies are using their power in state legislatures to make it illegal for Americans to vote on economic issues in cities and counties. This started with the minimum wage. Indiana in 2011 was the first state to do it, because in most states there are cities that are more progressive than the state as a whole. And there's been a whole trend of cities voting to increase their minimum wage, to create a right to paid sick leave, to say, you know, you have to have fair scheduling. Like, your employer can't say, you need to be on call this whole week. We'll call you when we need you, but you need to be available the whole week or you're fired, but we don't guarantee you any hours. Right? There have been laws to do away with that, and they happen at the city level. And the response of the corporate lobbies is to pass laws in the state legislature, because that's where their power is greatest, making it illegal for cities to pass those laws.
Yes, that's happening in Texas.
Is that right?
Yes.
So, and they've increasingly, they've passed, you know, Michigan passed a law that its opponents called the Death Star Bill. They said it's illegal for any city to vote on minimum wage, on sick leave, on scheduling, on paid or unpaid breaks, even on a ways for recovering stolen wages from your employer. So this is them saying, you know, if you have a democracy that has free and fair elections, but all you're allowed to vote on is the color of the flag, it doesn't help you very much. And because they know that their positions are unpopular among both Republicans and Democrats, their solution is to try to say, you're not allowed to vote about that anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And they represent, and I, you know, I look at Texas, but I know it's, I see it all over the place, is that these incredible, Austin, Texas, which is a liberal bastion, you know, Austin's an incredibly progressive state, city, has like five congressional districts in it. And they're just little slivers, you know, that go, and four of them are Republican. And the fifth, Lloyd Doggett, has just a little part of Austin now, and he stretches all the way up the state to San Antonio. And so basically Austin isn't represented. And that's not all that unusual. And then they're crazy, you know, they're going after Austin, but not just Austin, is for sanctuary city issues and for plastic bags, you know.
Yes.
They don't want them to be, and all this private property, private rights, you know, kind of stuff. You can't keep people from cutting down trees in order to make your community more beautiful. I mean, it's just the state. I mean, obviously, the further you go down the spectrum, the cities are the ones who most have to run things. You know, city officials are most involved in actually making things happen. And that's why they tend to be the most progressive, because they're also the most pragmatic.
Right.
He said.
Well, yes, I mean, they've been, look, their goal is to say, is to take away from citizens the ability to improve our own labor standards and also the ability to regulate corporate behavior. So this is an ALEC, you know, cookie cutter model bill, is say you can't pass a regulation about plastic bag. You can't regulate fracking.
That's another one in Texas, too.
You can't regulate the interest rates on payday loans. These are all things that ALEC has promoted in order to stop citizens from being able to regulate corporate behavior, even as consumers or people who, you know, environmental issues, not just as workers.
Are they going to privatize everything?
They would like to. And, you know, I think some of that is about making money. And some of that, you know, I hate to say this, like if you're the corporate elite, the big political challenge that they face is, how do we pursue an agenda that is going to make the country yet more unequal, that is going to make life worse for the majority of Americans without provoking a political backlash? And one of the ways that they want to do it, I think, is to lower everybody's expectations. So if I come to feel like, okay, my kid's in a class with 35 kids, but at least it's not 45. You know, they fired all the librarians and they only have music and phys ed 9 weeks a year. That's the case for my daughter. But at least they have it for 9 weeks a year. Like, I only have catastrophic health insurance, but at least I have it, and meanwhile, I'm not sick, right? Every time we ratchet down what we think we have a right to expect, either from our jobs or from government services, it normalizes downward mobility, and right, it makes the danger of rebellion less for them. And I think that's part of privatizing services, is not just enabling tax breaks for the rich. It's taking away the idea that just as a citizen, you have a right to certain things.
Yeah.
And when we look, you know, there's not many things that most Americans think we have a right to. People don't think we have a right to health care. We don't have a right to housing. You don't necessarily have a right to food and water. People think we have a right to have our kids get a decent education and a right to have the mail delivered.
Yeah.
And both things are under attack.
And you know what? One thing that's kind of moving a little from one column to the other is the right to have health care. And I think, you know, more and more people, and the Republicans are discovering this, obviously the Trump administration discovered it dramatically, is that you establish that and people don't want to lose it. because it does offer incredible benefits. And so, I mean, everywhere else in the industrialized world, there's universal health care, and it's just an assumption. Here it's socialism, you know. Well,
I think that's right.
It is,
but
socialism,
again,
but go ahead.
It's a difference between the population and the politicians. Throughout the healthcare debate in the Congress, where we ended up with Obamacare, a majority of Americans not only supported a public option, they supported single payer, and they said yes, healthcare should be a right. So you're right. This is what Republicans are discovering now, and among themselves, you know, some of the corporate activists, what they say about healthcare is not just that they don't want people to have healthcare, but that it sets a dangerous precedent of making people. No. Can meet your basic needs by having the government tax rich people right. And getting it as a right of citizenship. And right. It's like, if they get this into their heads about health care, maybe
then what's next?
Thing about public transit or housing, and that's what scares them.
Right, right. And it's interesting because we're about to take a break, but the I think we have the relationship, the ratio between the public and private in our society. Is probably the greatest, I think, in the Western world, or in most of the world. I mean, it skews so much towards the private over the public that I think that's an incidental fact Rag Radio is throwing out there for you folks. We're talking with Gordon Lafer, author of The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America One State at a Time. We'll be back right after this.
Woo. You sure gotta climb a lot of steps to get to this Capitol building here in Washington. Well, I wonder who that sad little scrap of paper is.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee. But I know I'll be a law someday. At least I hope and pray that I will. But today I am still just a bill.
Gee, Bill, you certainly have a lot of patience and courage.
Well, I got this far. When I started, I wasn't even a bill. I was just an idea. Some folks back home decided they wanted a law passed, so they called their local congressman, and he said, "You're right, there ought to be a law." Then he sat down and wrote me out and introduced me to Congress, and I became a bill. And I'll remain a bill until they decide to make me a law. I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I got as far as Capitol Hill. Well, now I'm stuck in committee, and I'll sit here and wait while a few key congressmen discuss and debate whether they should let me be.
Excellent, excellent. Tracy, what were we listening to there?
Well, that was an all-time classic, I'm Just a Bill by Schoolhouse Rock. I figured since we were talking a little bit about changes in laws and things like that, a little reaffirming that folks still have a say, at least for now.
Yeah, we'll let them have a little say so that they think they have a big say. Gordon Lafer is my guest, and we've been talking about his book, The 1% Solution, and the role that that ALEC and corporate lobbyists have been playing in, especially working on the state level to change laws in favor of corporate needs, as it were, corporate profits. It's especially about, and is the incredible concentration of wealth in this country, which keeps becoming more concentrated and more concentrated. How do we turn that around?
I think that the most promising thing I can think of, and I'm not like a rose-colored glasses guy, but that the most promising thing is to build campaigns around specific issues rather than candidates or parties, and to run them at the local or state level. I think that's the... That's a place where there's a lot of bipartisan support for a lot of progressive things, and that's where I would concentrate energy.
You know, Tom Hayden was on here a few years ago. I don't remember when this was, because he's been on a bunch of times. He was on a bunch of times. Rest in peace. But he talked about, and of course, being in California, he talked about that he thought that the states at that point, that the states were going to be the bastions, or some of the states were going to be the bastions for turning things around and creating a different kind of kind of culture, different kind of economy within the larger one. On the local level, certainly in the cities, we're really seeing that happen.
And I think that, you know, there's sometimes examples that are set in one place can really inspire people in other places. I think that happened with the minimum wage, where the first place that won a $15 minimum wage was the Seattle airport in SeaTac. And I think then people looked at it and said, hey, you know, if somebody's getting 15 bucks for making burgers or lattes in the Seattle airport, maybe we should get that at LAX or Houston or Kennedy or whatever. And then it started spreading, even to places where the politics was different, because it built such public support for realizing that if it was affordable someplace else and we're doing the same work, we should be able to get that too, that it raises people's expectations. So, you know, there's not a formula, but I do think there's grounds for hope.
It happened with healthcare too. You know, thanks to Mitt Romney, bless his little pea picking heart. you know, I mean, but still, whenever you set an example and people realize that things actually make their lives better, it becomes not about politics. You know,
that's right.
Certainly not about sectarian politics. You were mentioning, we were talking off mic a minute ago or at break, and you said that you wanted to talk about some of the more outrageous kind of laws and things that have happened as a result of all this. Go for it.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, there's some things that you kind of can't believe. So one of them is, you know, the corporate lobbies and especially the National Restaurant Association is always looking for a way to steal more money out of the pockets of waiters and waitresses. One of the things they did, this was in the state of Maine. You know, if you go to a lot of restaurants and you have a big group, you know, 8 people or more, they say instead of letting you just make up your own tip, they add a service charge onto the bill. Maine passed a law saying that the service charge in situations like that belongs to management and not to the employees, and that the restaurant does not have to notify people, customers, about it. So you go to a restaurant, you see whatever it is, 15% service charge, you figure that's going to the waiters and waitresses, so you don't add another tip, and they're just stiffed on it, and it goes into the pocket of management. That's a straight transfer of money from people doing the work to the people who own the restaurant, done by law, done by the influence in state legislatures.
Wow. Yeah.
There's also a number of states that change the definition of being independent contractors. And this is one of those things that as soon as you start talking about it, most people's eyes glaze over and they fall asleep. And because of that, the other side wins. You know, if you go to work someplace and they say, we're not going to call you an employee, we're going to say you're an independent business, you're an independent contractor, that means you have no right to overtime, you don't get health insurance, you don't get a pension. If they have stock options, you don't get stock options. You're not covered by workplace safety rules. And so there used to be strict rules. They say you can't just decide somebody's an independent contractor. They have to meet certain standards, including the fact that if they're really an independent business, they should have more than one per client that they're working for. So these states are changing the laws with the backing of the Chamber of Commerce and ALEC and all those guys to make it easier for any employer to just decide, I'm going to consider you your own independent business, so I don't have to pay you all this money or give you all these rights. So that's something, again, nobody can bear to pay attention to this stuff until you show up someplace and all of a sudden you don't have any of the rights and you're not getting paid overtime. So those are some of the things that are like very small details but end up in the transfer of hundreds of millions of dollars from workers to owners or investors.
We're talking with Gordon Lafer. The book is The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America One State at a Time. Tell me some things that you see out there as hopeful and some things that you think we need to do to sort of try to kind of start turning this stuff around. Obviously, we can't do it alone. It has to be, we have to do it together.
So, you know, the things that I see as hopeful are places where people have been able to vote on issues. And it's not just minimum wage. On house, you know, class size in public education, for instance, is something where the corporate lobbies are always trying to increase the class size. In Florida, Florida had good class size caps written into their state constitution, like only 18 kids until third grade and then 24 kids after that. And the legislature wanted to undo it. But because it was in the constitution, they had to get the voters' approval. So the legislators all voted for it. They went to the voters, and the voters rejected it. Now, this was 2010, which was the Tea Party wave election. Florida elected a very right-wing governor and right-wing legislators. So a whole bunch of people went to the polls thinking something like, I hate government, I hate taxes, I hate Democrats, I hate unions, but I want my kid in small classes. And I think there are a lot of issues like that, and we have to look for those issues where there is common ground between people who vote for very different candidates but who believe similar things. That's about public services, about workers' rights, about environmental rights. I think there's a lot of ground for that, and we have to be fighting on those issues basis instead of, you know, I would say most of the places where the worst laws have passed are in states that are controlled by the Republican Party. But it's not like Democrats are God's gift to working people, and it's hard to go
Thank
out
you.
And say,
it's
you know,
true.
You can be really excited yeah. about the Democrats. It's much more fruitful to fight around issues.
Right, right. How can we do that in this country right now, though? It's so divided. Is it divided beyond hope, or is it just an is that?
I don't think it's divided beyond hope. I mean,
especially in the political arena, is what I'm talking about.
It may be divided beyond hope about which candidates people vote for. But again, I think there are a lot of issues, and it depends which state you live in and which city you live in, you know, how easy it is to vote on issues. I live in the West Coast, where like a ballot initiative haven. It's relatively easy to put things on the ballot. In places where that's true, I think there's still a lot of grounds for hope.
What about public schools? You know, I mean, there's two aspects to this. One is that I believe that a lot of the problems we have in the political arena, a lot of the bad people that we elect, bad being a judgment call, is because people are not very well educated. People certainly are not very well informed about what's going on in politics. It seems like our public school system is a disgrace. And the privatization of it that's going on certainly doesn't seem to be likely to help that.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, we live in an Orwellian time where it's always, you know, the Polluters Association is called Citizens for a Green Economy, and everybody who intervenes in schools says they want to do it to make education better. But again, and this is part of there's a chapter in this book that is just about education, and what it tries to do with education, like everything else, is to say, let's not talk about what people say. Let's look at what they actually do. What the big corporate money is doing in education is privatizing it through vouchers and charters, cutting the funding, and dumbing down the standard of what's expected. Where we're going to go back to a situation where the rich people's kids will get education in small classes with experienced, licensed teachers in person about a broad range of topics. And increasingly, what everybody else will get is just reading and math, taught by inexperienced, high turnover teachers or on digital applications without any creative thinking, any self-expression, or any broad curriculum. That is I feel like as a parent, it's heartbreaking to just look at some of the stuff that is being done to education. And we need to know this is not ideology. This is people who want to make money off of it and who I think want to destroy the idea of a public education. Of course, there are good and bad private schools, there are good and bad charter schools, but in general, the direction of undermining public education, of having high turnover, you know, kids through Teach for America who teach for a couple of years and leave, never really learn how to be good teachers, of doing away with social studies and lab science and drama and art. You know, you can read a lot of educational research, but the easy way without doing any research to know what a good school is to look at where rich people send their kids to school. And, you know, as a parent, I feel like my education policy would be simple in one sentence: is everybody should have the right to the thing that Rahm Emanuel's kids have at the University of Chicago Lab School.
Really. It's crazy. I mean, I just get overwhelmed with how crazy it is sometimes. With education, as with so many other areas, it's all short sight. It's all immediate. It's this way with climate change and that kind of thing. It's not having a sense of what happens today after tomorrow, and in that sense, not knowing how to really prepare students for the world. You don't teach them how to learn, you know, which is the most important thing that traditionally schools have done. It's to let you know how to learn. So I don't know.
I think that's right. And there's a lot of attacks on teachers' unions, which I think turn out to be totally misplaced. I mean, if you look at there are 10 states in America that have no teachers' unions, where teachers have no contracts. And if you say, oh, well, does it turn out that education is a lot better, the test scores are higher, or dropout rates are lower? Absolutely not. And, you know, the people who attack teachers' unions always try to remind us of the teachers we hated as kids and wished could be fired. And believe me, I still remember those people. But when you do away with tenure, you don't get just the good teachers who are left. You get teachers who have low pay, who have high stress, who are insecure, who are afraid to do anything but teach for the test. And that's not the way to improve a system. I think when we look at why are teachers' unions under attack, the main reason they're under attack is they're the one main political force that is standing in the way of the corporate lobbies totally remaking education in a way that is going to be worse for the vast majority of people in the country.
Do we need four-year tuition-free public education?
I think so, and I think we can afford it.
I think Canada just, I think, is just initiating it now.
Well, I mean, you see even, you know, not huge numbers, but numbers of American kids now going to Germany because they can get free education in Germany. So if Germany can figure out how to do it, Germany's not a communist country. They're not crazy. I don't know why we can't figure out how to do it. And working class kids who are smart and do well in high school should be able to get an affordable higher education. I think that's a no-brainer.
Right. Okay, we've got about 5 minutes left. What do you want to talk about? What haven't we covered? I mean, I can go into more stuff, but I know there's things that I don't think to ask that are of interest to you and that you might want to.
Well, you know, one of the things I said in the beginning is I think the corporate lobbies are increasingly, not totally, but increasingly Americans don't matter to them, either as workers, as taxpayers, or as consumers. And we've seen, you know, this gets kind of dystopic and very pessimistic, but there have been a lot of comments by the Wall Street elite saying America's becoming so unequal that we're going to blow up, or there's going to be something like the French Revolution. And you'd think that the next sentence would be, therefore, we need to pay more taxes and make the system more equal. Instead, what they say, and they've said this openly, a number of people, all the hedge funders are buying their own private islands with their own private planes. Or there are now three companies in the Midwest that are selling luxury survival condos where for $5 or $10 million, you can buy a condo underground in an old nuclear missile silo with a 5-year supply of food so that when society falls apart, you and your family will be okay. I think in some ways, we need to recapture the idea of what is patriotism really? And that patriotism can't be robbing the country while knowing that you have your penthouse in Shanghai to run to when things fall apart. And that part of what we're seeing is this kind of disinvestment from America, and part of what patriotism has to be is insisting on reinvesting in the country. And I know this sounds like a politician's speech. I don't mean it to sound that way, but trying to build again an economy where normal working people have a decent shot, not at being rich, but at being secure.
You know, we see, I mean, when you mentioned that, the idea of dystopian sci-fi, you know, I mean, do you see there's so many paths we could see that lead us into those directions, and incredibly, and especially the concentration of wealth, but so many other things that are so crazy. I think the book is very important, and I think that it covers a lot of things that people don't think about. I just wonder. I wonder. Education, I think, is one incredibly important thing. The union movement, does it still have a chance to survive? I mean, how?
It does have a chance, and I think that's critical. I mean, it's not. I'm not very optimistic. But you know, when you get at a time like this, when there's a lot of people being economically insecure, it cuts both ways. On the one hand, people are afraid to speak out and to be activists, to organize a union in their workplace because they're afraid of getting fired. And on the other hand, they want it more than ever because they're suffering more than ever. And if you look at not just historically what built the middle class, it's just logical. Companies are in the business of making profit. And the heart of the crisis in America is that it used to be that when productivity went up because workers worked harder or worked smarter, profits went up and wages went up. And then those two things, essentially the relationship between hard work and fair pay, broke down. So now we have productivity going up, profits going up, executive salaries going up, and wages staying flat. Unions are the most important and most effective ways to fix that. that all it does is enable a group of workers someplace to negotiate with their boss and to come to an agreement that both sides can live with, that the company is still profitable, but that a fair share of the profits that workers create goes into their and their families' pockets. So finding ways to revive the labor movement, I think, is absolutely critical.
Okay. Gordon Lafer, author of The 1% Solution, How Corporations Are Remaking America One State at a Time. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I think this has been enlightening, and we should do it again sometime. So
thank
maybe,
you.
Maybe next book. So I do want to tell people next week, government professor and Middle East expert Roy Casagrande, who's been on the show a couple of times. In the past, we talked about Iraq and Syria and how they laid the groundwork for ISIS and so forth, and how the United States helped lay the groundwork. But we're going to talk this time, I don't know exactly, I wrote down Donald Trump puts his foot in it and other tall tales. But we're going to be talking about the Trump administration and foreign policy, I think, mostly. Also, I wanted to remind people, if you don't know about it, you know, we did a book called Celebrating the Rag, which is about Austin's iconic underground newspaper. Alice Embry, Richard Croxdale, and I will be at Houston's Brazos Bookstore Thursday, May 18th at 7 p.m. And so you all be there if you're in Houston, especially. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio.